Let's start out if we can, and I'm wondering if you can give me a brief bio of yourself.
I'm Daniel Axelrod, a professor of physics at the University of Michigan. I specialize in optics and biophysics. I've also taught for several semesters a course on science and strategy in the nuclear arms race here at the university. And I'm a co-author of a book with Michio Kaku of City College of New York, To Win a Nuclear War, The Pentagon's Secret War Plans.
I just discovered your book a couple years ago and found it to be a must-read, I think, for all Americans. I would sincerely hope that it could somehow be integrated into all our history classes. I think it's so important, the information that you brought out in that. What prompted you to write your book?
In the early 80s, it became clear that the expansion of nuclear weapon systems didn't seem consistent with the policy that all Americans were told. The policy we were told was that we should be able to strike back at the Soviet Union if they strike first. But the nature of the weapons that were being made did not seem appropriate for that. It seemed more appropriate for striking the Soviet Union first. And that being the case, it raised questions about what the real nuclear policy was. And that was the reason for investigating this. And we found a lot of interesting information about what nuclear policy was a long way back, and various documents from Freedom of Information Act that confirmed the developing theory.
I think one of the many mind-blowing pieces of information that you clarified for us in that book was the whole concept of first strike. And as a child, I grew up thinking that we were told that we would never strike first, but you found many documents supporting that we in fact would. When did the U.S. first put that on the planning books?
Well, of course, actually, the U.S. did strike first with nuclear weapons at the end of World War II against Japan. But as soon as that was done, it became apparent to various civilian and military leaders that here was a weapon that was vastly more powerful than any other country had, and maybe some political or military use could be made out of it. So there were advocates in the government who were saying that we should immediately build up our nuclear strategy and nuclear armaments while we had a monopoly, and then use them as a first strike against the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, of course, was our ally in World War II, but became clear right after World War II that the coming years would be a contention between our side, which was capitalist, and their side, which was socialist.
So can you tell us about some of the actual plans that the U.S. put together?
Well, some of them were National Security Council documents, which were more on the order of contingency plans, and others were actually operational plans with specific targets. For example, one of the first ones from the Joint Chiefs of Staff in December 1945, JIC 329, posited a plan where 20 to 30 bombs would be dropped on 20 Soviet cities. And that was updated only 6 months after that with a plan called Operation Pincher, which postulated 50 bombs on 20 cities. And then 2 years after that, 1948, Operation Broiler, 34 bombs on 24 cities. And they keep escalating in the numbers of bombs and numbers of cities with funny names: Frolic, Sizzle, Trojan, Shakedown, Drop Shot, all the way from the mid-40s all the way through the early 50s. The idea of all of these plans was to hit the Soviet Union, most of this time before the Soviet Union had any nuclear weapons of its own, in a way that the Soviet Union would collapse as a nation. You might wonder, well, why weren't these plans actually carried out? We're often told that the U.S. was responsible with its nuclear weapons. It had a monopoly, but it didn't think it was moral to start a nuclear war. But actually, a closer investigation of the history shows something somewhat more technical rather than moral. It turns out that the U.S. was worried that if they attacked the Soviet Union, the Soviets could still retaliate with their conventional army in the Middle East, which borders on the southwest part of the country, or to the west in Europe. And the U.S. government calculated that it would take a lot more bombs to completely stop the Soviet army from being able to generate an advance than were actually available. There were actually very few U.S. nuclear bombs available during these times. For example, in Operation Pincher in 1946 called for 50 bombs on 20 cities as a minimum necessary to prevent the Soviet Union from a conventional retaliation. But there were only 9 bombs in the stockpile. This continued more or less for the next few years. And then, of course, the Soviets in 1949 got their first atomic bomb, which was a big surprise to U.S. planners. And that then meant that the Soviets could, in some sense or other, retaliate, not just with conventional weapons, but also with nuclear weapons. And any planning from that point on had to take that into account.
I find it absolutely mind-blowing that it happened so quickly after the war that we began making plans for decimating the Soviet Union.
Well, actually, there's another interesting thing that turned out from these and other studies, that the Soviet Union wasn't always the target, at least not the primary target. For example, the fact that the U.S. had dominance, in fact, a monopoly on nuclear weapons in those years, meant to some nuclear strategists that the monopoly could be used as a threat to make things happen in the Third World. So, for example, after the war, the Soviet Union, the U.S., and Britain were squabbling over who would control Iran. There was an agreement before the end of World War II that that country would be split and its oil would be split 3 ways. But now with this nuclear monopoly, the U.S. said, we don't want the Soviet Union to be involved there at all. So the Soviet Union started massing troops near the border, and the U.S., Truman, made a threat to the Soviet Union that you better withdraw your troops from the border area or we will nuclear bomb you within 48 hours. The Soviet Union withdrew its troops in 24 hours. This little sequence of events was a very heady experience because it meant that if you're a policymaker in Washington, all you had to do was threaten nuclear bombing and you could make things happen even in areas that were not the Soviet homeland.
I think a lot of people would be shocked to find out how many times the U.S. actually came close to using nuclear weapons on a large scale as well as on a smaller scale. Can you give us an idea about that?
Yeah, there's of course a question about how close is close. We have a very good idea now of when nuclear threats were made. Some of the nuclear threats may not have been effective and others may have been. It's hard to tell what was in the minds of whoever we were threatening, but threats were made, and often they were made against non-nuclear countries. But I mentioned the one in Iran, which was in March of 1946. There were some threats against the Soviet Union over the Berlin crisis in 1948. There were threats against China in the Korean War, 1950 and 1953. The U.S. In 1954 actually offered a couple of atomic bombs to the French that they could use in Vietnam because Vietnam at that time was French Indochina or part of French Indochina. and the revolutionaries in Vietnam had surrounded the French at the Nguyen Phu, and the U.S. thought that possibly they could help our allies, the French, in extricating themselves by using nuclear weapons. I guess fortunately the French refused because they thought it might hurt their own troops there. There were many others. There was the offshore islands off China in the mid-50s, actually 54 and 58, that were a scene of a clash between Chinese government on the mainland and the government of Taiwan. These are just tiny, desolate islands 2 miles off the Chinese mainland. But the leader of Taiwan wanted to show that he was ready to take back all of China. So he put lots of troops on those islands, and the Chinese from the mainland responded by shelling those islands. The U.S. was on the side of the Taiwanese government and made threats to China that we will nuclear bomb China if they don't stop shelling these two tiny offshore islands. That crisis eventually got resolved in a kind of almost seems like a silly solution that Taiwan could rearm their troops on even numbered days and China could shell on odd numbered days. But it's an example of how nuclear threats were made even over an affair that was not important in any way. One reason why the U.S. didn't actually go ahead with nuclear bombing China, which of course was not a nuclear country in those days, is because our allies in Europe, England, France, and so on, thought that it wasn't worth the trouble and the danger to starting a nuclear war and possibly involving the Soviet Union over something so minor. In fact, it's a little bit reminiscent of what's going on today, where the U.S. government wants to take a preemptive role in striking Iraq, and our allies in Europe, except for the British, do not support it. There were many others, too. There was, of course, in Berlin again in the early 60s, there were nuclear threats against the Soviet Union. The Cuban Missile Crisis, which is a well-known affair involving nuclear threats. And there were some ones that are very instructive to learn about that occurred in Vietnam. You know, there were, for those of us who remember, there were public calls by politicians and many others for nuking Hanoi. It actually turns out that there were a number of officials in the government who were advocating that too. But one of them actually was Richard Nixon, and of course his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. They developed a plan in early 1969 called Operation Duck Hook. Operation Duck Hook was apparently a fulfillment of what Nixon had campaigned on for his election to president in 1968, where he said he had a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam. And this operation turned out to be to threaten to drop nuclear bombs over rail lines that connect North Vietnam with China. And the threats were backed up by increasing the what's called the DEFCON status of the U.S., which is a rating of what the readiness level of U.S. nuclear forces are. Of course, when the U.S. increases its DEFCON level, that doesn't mean that the Vietnamese know about it, but certainly the Soviets know about that because they're watching for that kind of thing, and they would tell the Vietnamese, hey, wait a second, did you receive any threats lately? The U.S. looks like it's getting ready for a war. So it turns out, though, that the Vietnamese did not respond. They did not fold because of this deliberate nuclear threat. The question only becomes why. Of course, one reason might be because, you know, this might have escalated into something involving the Soviet Union and then things would become very unpredictable. But another reason is actually talked about by Nixon himself. He wrote in his memoirs, and other people have written, that at the time that the November 1st ultimatum, November 1st, 1969, was to be acted upon against Vietnam, just before that, there were huge anti-war demonstrations in the U.S. and elsewhere, and Nixon was worried that there wouldn't be sufficient public support for a nuclear strike against Vietnam, so he did not do it. So those are some examples. There were other examples in the Middle East and Iran and so on, and even in later years. But the lesson to draw from these is that nuclear weapons and nuclear weapon superiority was not thought about as just a way of inhibiting a Soviet first strike. It was thought of as part of the U.S.'s military muscle in order to get affairs ordered the way it wants in other parts of the world, even parts that were non-nuclear.
And there were many proponents within the U.S. who felt that, I believe Dulles was one of them, that nuclear weapons were considered now conventional weapons.
Oh, yes, there were many statements to that effect, even statements to that effect from McNamara, who was considered, you know, an advocate of mutually assured destruction. We would only hit them if they hit us. So, for example, Alexander Haig, who was Reagan's Secretary of State, he clearly reserved the right of the U.S. to be the first to use nuclear weapons, what would have been a conventional war up until that time. He said, quote, "A pledge against the first use of nuclear weapons would be tantamount to making Europe safe for conventional aggression. A no-first-use policy would be the end of the very credibility of the Western strategy of deterrence." What he's saying is that if we promise not to use nuclear weapons first, then our other threats won't work so well. Another nuclear strategist in a longer essay wrote, "To have the superiority at the utmost level of violence helps at every lesser level." So it's not that these strategists always just wanted to go ahead and start a nuclear war, although certainly some of them did. But all of them wanted to use a nuclear superiority as a threat-making tool. And making threats from nuclear weapons is not an easy affair because they're so big and they're so destructive, it's possible that nobody will believe you if you threaten to use them, and then they wouldn't be any good. It would be like a bank robber going into the bank, and instead of using a pistol or something concealed in a paper bag, he would say, "I'm going to blow up the whole block." I mean, that wouldn't be a credible threat. So the problem is that here you have this huge kind of weapon, but you're only trying to get some mileage in some third world country. You know, you want to secure oil or minerals or some political influence or whatever. So you don't want to threaten to blow up the whole world. So the whole idea of making a nuclear threat credible depends on having a whole graduated escalation ladder go from small conventional weapons to larger ones to small nuclear weapons to large ones, and they're all designed for specific targets and sort of a controlled escalation. So if you make a threat, you don't have to say we're going to blow up the whole world. You say, oh, we're going to just ratchet up the violence one level and skip from non-nuclear conventional weapons to small nuclear weapons with one easy step. So the idea of making this a credible strategy, this what you might call escalation dominance, you threaten to escalate a war slowly, step by step, the idea is to eliminate what used to be called a nuclear firebreak. You know, there used to be a big separation between the power of conventional weapons and the power of nuclear weapons, and nobody should want to cross that firebreak. But of course, if there is a firebreak, you can't use nuclear weapons as a threat in some conventional war. So much of nuclear strategy on the U.S. side since the late 50s has been to fill up the missing steps on that escalation ladder with more accurate, larger conventional weapons and smaller and more accurate nuclear weapons.
The example you gave earlier with Nixon threatening to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam as a solution to Vietnam. Was that at the same time where Kissinger had put the U.S. into DEFCON 1 for a period of, I believe, like 30 days just to send a message to the Soviets?
That's right. That was in 1969.
So he notched this up to total nuclear war just to send this message to the Soviet premier?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, there's a flexibility there in there too. It's more that Kissinger wanted to send a clear message to Vietnam and the Soviets that we were willing to climb up this escalation ladder, and they should respond by the North Vietnamese should basically give up the struggle against the foreigners, which were was the U.S. at the time.
So the concept of escalation dominance, certainly the planners and thinkers on our side used that a lot in their thinking. Did you find evidence that the Soviet Union used a similar strategy or way of thinking?
Well, it's possible the Soviet Union would have wanted to, because, you know, it's a little hard to do well in the world when there's an all-out nuclear war, and it's also hard to use nuclear weapons as a threat unless you have an escalation ladder. The problem was the Soviet Union was always considerably behind in their numbers and sophistication of their weapons. So what they were limited to, basically, just because of technical reasons, they were limited to threatening massive retaliation. So it did not give them the ability to make first strike or first use nuclear threats, just because their armaments weren't as accurate or sophisticated or mobile. But certainly the threat was always there that if the U.S. did start a nuclear war with their first use policy, the Soviet Union wanted us to believe that they would respond with an all-out war. So the Soviet Union's policy was to emphasize how any nuclear war will escalate all the way to the top, and therefore it shouldn't be started in the first place, whereas the U.S.'s nuclear policy was to say that we have a graduated escalation ladder, and therefore any nuclear threats at an intermediate level are credible.
Talk a bit about the information that you gathered on the U.S. first strike capability and how our weapons we were developing clearly show that we were pursuing a first strike in a lot of these situations.
Yeah. Well, first, if you just think of an all-out first strike against the Soviet Union, you know, it seems ridiculous because, in isolation, you wouldn't want to start something like that because you're never sure of what the response is going to be or how things are going to work out. That's not how it was conceived, at least not in the later years when the Soviets had their own nuclear weapons. What was conceived is that a conventional war would not go the way that the U.S. wanted, say in the Middle East or in Southeast Asia, and we would introduce small tactical nuclear weapons. Then if the other side didn't respond in the way we wanted, or if they got the Soviets to make some moves in the area, we would escalate to intermediate range, and this would go back and forth, at least according to the plan, until it became an all-out nuclear war with each side striking the other side's homeland. And in order to make the whole concept of this escalation credible, you had to show, at least on paper, that if it did escalate that far, you could hit the other side, the U.S., for example, could hit the Soviets first with a devastating strike so that they would not be able to respond. Because, of course, if they could respond, then, all bets are off and the threats weren't worth anything. So you want to show that the first strike against the Soviet homeland could be carried out and avoid a retaliation. Not that anybody thought that this was a good idea out of the blue, but it would be a good idea to show on paper at the upper level of an escalation ladder So what do you need to make a credible first strike against the Soviet homeland? Well, you have to knock out their ability to retaliate. So we're not talking about the kinds of weapons that would just wipe out their cities, because that kind of weapon is appropriate for mutually assured destruction. You know, you better not start up with us or we'll get you back and we'll both wipe out each other's cities, and that wouldn't fly. So therefore, there won't be a nuclear war. That policy of striking the other side's cities was not an appropriate military strategy. The idea is to hit the other side's missiles so that they couldn't retaliate. That's a first strike. So how do you hit the other side's missiles? You need very accurate missiles on your own side. That's one element, because the other side's missiles are buried in hardened silos, and you have to make sure to hit them right on. Then you need a very sophisticated command and control system so you can do this all by surprise, because if the other side knows it's coming, they'll launch their retaliation before your missiles actually strike. You need some way of blinding them, just in case that they can get off some kind of weak retaliation. You have to protect yourself against the retaliation. So there's all these elements necessary for a first strike. There's high accuracy against military targets, surprise, and the ability to protect yourself against a response. And every one of those requirements was approached by a very particular weapon system, particularly developing in the 70s and 80s. The MX missile system, the land-based missiles, the Trident submarine-based missile system, were not only overwhelming in the numbers of nuclear bombs, but also in their accuracy. They were clearly meant to be targeted against the other side's retaliation, not against the other side's cities, so that, of course, any country that sees its own missiles being targeted will get very nervous. Then there was an anti-satellite system that was actually being developed by both sides, although it was more sophisticated on the U.S. side, to blind the other side, so the attack would be a more or less of a surprise, or at least the other side wouldn't be able to respond in the 30 minutes they had available. And then you want to be able to protect yourself in a first strike against a retaliation. Now, if the other side is hitting you with a first strike, that's done with overwhelming force and by surprise, and it's very hard to defend against a first strike from the other side, whichever side you're on. But it's a lot easier to defend yourself against a retaliation, because if you can hit the other side's missile systems, knock out most of them, then their retaliation is going to be much weaker, or probably uncoordinated, because their communication systems will be down. And, of course, it won't be by surprise, because you just hit them, you know, you can expect that they're going to retaliate. So a retaliation, a second strike, is much weaker than a first strike. But nevertheless, it could be quite devastating to American cities. We hit the Soviets, for example, with a first strike, and they have a second strike retaliation. Although it's very weak, it would still kill tens of millions of people, maybe hundreds of millions. So we had to be able to show on paper that we can protect against a second strike retaliation. And that's what the Star Wars system was designed for. Everybody was saying in those days, oh, the Star Wars system, you know, will never protect against the Soviet first strike effectively, because even if 1% of the missiles make it through, if you have tens of thousands of warheads, that's a lot of warheads still coming through. But that wasn't what the purpose of Star Wars really was. The purpose of Star Wars was not to protect against a full-blast first strike. It was to protect against a retaliation after we do a first strike on them, because the retaliation from them then would be much weaker and could be better handled by a Star Wars system. So in a way, the Star Wars was not designed as a peacemaking defense against Soviet first strike. It was basically the shield that goes with the sword. The sword was the MX missile system and the Tridents, and the shield is the Star Wars system to protect ourselves against a response. So all these weapons at this global level fit into a pattern that said first strike rather than assured retaliation. Then, of course, at all the lower levels, there were tactical short-range and intermediate-range weapon systems being developed to reduce the fire break between conventional weapons and nuclear weapons and fill up those missing rungs on the escalation ladder.
So our current push for national missile defense or theater missile defense, it would be fair to say it is part of a first strike system and not a defensive shield as has been sold to the American people.
Well, the way it was sold in the 80s under Reagan was as a defensive shield where we're passive and they're attacking us when actually it was an aggressive shield, a shield that goes with a sword. Nowadays, though, particularly with Bush's newly stated nuclear posture review that came out in March, actually it was leaked to the press, the policy is now explicitly to introduce nuclear weapons where necessary into conventional conflicts in the Third World. And, you know, some favorite enemies were listed as potential nuclear targets: Syria, Libya, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, China, as well as the Soviet Union. And of those, the only one that has nuclear weapons is the Soviet Union and China. The other ones are non-nuclear, and of course we're not expecting that they're going to be hitting us with an all-out nuclear first strike. I mean, they don't even have missiles capable of reaching us. So the purpose of Star Wars, it's related now, but it's somewhat different. It uses the same sorts of space-based and land-based technologies to shoot down missiles, but it's thought of more now as a more advanced way of fighting wars in the Third World.
And we see that we're still coming close, at least verbally, the threat of using nuclear weapons. I know there was multiple people publicly calling for such when we were at the peak of attacks on Afghanistan, and I know that, for instance, Scott Ritter, who's currently talking across the country, has mentioned, at least in his Canada talks, that he foresees potentially the U.S. using a nuclear bomb in its conflict with Iraq. Do you see those as possibilities?
Well, it certainly is a possibility, partly because some of the targets that we're supposedly aiming for may be located in hardened underground chambers. At least that's what they're talking about. And they think that a small nuclear weapon would be more effective there. So in a military sense, they are talking about it. But there's also a political sense here that the U.S. government is always attempting to remind the world and show examples that we are the only superpower in the world, and we are willing to use our military to get our way. And making a threat to use nuclear weapons and making a seamless bridge from conventional to nuclear makes what seems a very impressive threat. So whether it actually happens or not depends on the situation. If these wars would start as conventional wars, so we start in Iraq, it would start as a conventional war. If the whatever the goals were are not achieved, then there certainly will be forces in the U.S. that push for escalating, even if necessary, to nuclear weapons, just to make our point.
It seems that it's in talk of the U.S. foreign policy these days that one of the terms that's always mixed in there is the world's last remaining superpower. And one of the things that doesn't seem to be discussed anymore via the definition of calling us a superpower was that a superpower generally was considered to have a massive number of nuclear weapons. Would you agree with that?
Well, certainly that's what defines superpower in the times when there were at least two superpowers in the world. But superpower now means something a little bit more effective or general. That's that the U.S. wants the capability to project power in any corner of the world and project it in such a way that it dominates. So whether it's nuclear or conventional, in the view of strategists, isn't the most important thing. The most important thing is just to dominate anywhere in the world. And whether that domination is done economically with boycotts or with economic blockades, or whether it's done by assassination or by invasions through surrogate forces, or whether it's direct military attack from the U.S. That range of possibilities, that flexibility, is what makes the U.S. an effective superpower.
When you first came up with the idea to write your book To Win a Nuclear War, did you envision or imagine that you would come across the information and the documents that you did?
Not really. You know, of course, the late 60s, mid-60s and late 60s and early 70s taught many people a lesson of whether the U.S.'s foreign policy was as holy and moral as stated, because the Vietnam War on its face was a cruel and unjustified invasion of a country 10,000 miles away. It was not even a threat to the U.S. So, of course, that raised many people's eyebrows as to exactly what's going on here. But it was still generally believed that nuclear weapons were apart from all this, that, well, the U.S. may have been aggressive or even imperialist with conventional weapons, but the only reason we had nuclear weapons is because it was sort of like a technical game between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and it just kind of got out of hand, and it had its own dynamics. What we didn't expect was that nuclear superiority was viewed as part of American foreign policy, and in fact an aid to it, even an aid to conventional threats. So it was that linking between conventional foreign policy and nuclear foreign policy that was a surprise. Maybe it shouldn't have been a surprise, because there were even unclassified works, not a lot of them, but there were books written in the late 50s on how you can use nuclear weapons to make political threats. And in fact, one of the most famous of those books was written by Henry Kissinger in the late 50s. And there he advocated something that didn't exist at that time, which was limited nuclear weapons. Nuclear bombs that could be introduced into a conventional war so that they would have a use other than just blowing up the world in retaliation.
I found it very intriguing in your book. One kind of oscillates between the horror of the things that you have dug up and then going 180 degrees across to joy, finding that there actually were people within the power structure that were steadfast against using these nuclear weapons in these insane scenarios.
Right. You know, there were basically two directions that opposition to this escalation ladder and first use plans came from. One direction was advisors and some officials, even in the government, who thought that it was too risky or insane, because once a war starts, literally all hell breaks loose and you can forget about your original plans. It's not going to work out that way. And, you know, that is probably a accurate view. The view of those who were in favor of using nuclear weapons as threats, though, wasn't so much that they wanted to use them, like I said, as that they wanted to make credible threats in order to arrange the world, maybe even without a shot being fired. But if necessary, they should be available for use. So there was this split in the government between folks who wanted to make nuclear threats backed up with a nuclear escalation ladder and those who thought that the whole thing was dangerous. Some of them, you know, had moral objections. They would even state that, you know, Americans should never accept their government using nuclear weapons first in any situation. Others thought that, oh, it's just too risky or too expensive to get the complete range of weapon systems you need to make a credible escalation ladder. But there were clearly splits at times in the government. One thing that was a little discouraging, actually, is that sometimes those who we now might consider more on the anti-war side just took their point of view because of the technical insufficiency of the weapons at that time. They thought that we couldn't carry out the first strike or even make a credible escalation ladder because we didn't have the weapons actually out there in the field. And it was important to wait as we madly developed more weapons.
Can you think of an example of someone who had promoted that?
Well, one example, which was actually kind of a surprise, was Robert McNamara, who in the years after became known as an advocate of restraint and mutually assured destruction. When he was Secretary of Defense under Kennedy, he was getting recommendations from all sides. We should build up our nuclear forces and have a credible first strike. And that side was bolstered by the realization at the time that the Soviet Union didn't have nearly as many missiles ready to fire as we thought they did. We had a superiority of 10 to 1, and that information came from spy satellites, which were just being put up in those days. So the more hawkish types said, hey, wait, we're so close to a first strike capability here, you know, let's go for it. And on the other side, there were, of course, people who said that, you know, you still can't be sure. So McNamara took a middle course. He didn't advocate a full first strike capability, but he did greatly increase research and development of escalation ladder, limited nuclear weapons, and first strike weapons, including the development of MIRVs, multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles. That means where more than one nuclear bomb is put on a missile. And he was not objecting to first use or to the nuclear escalation ladder for moral reasons. He was just holding back because he thought we didn't have the goods yet to make it into a credible threat.
You wrote your book, To Win a Nuclear War, about 15 years ago, is that right?
Right.
What significant changes have you seen since you wrote the book? It seems right now that our current administration appears to be very single-minded in tearing up treaties that stopped the or slowed the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Do you see things as getting worse, getting better?
Well, of course, the biggest change was that the Soviet Union no longer exists, and what's left are Russia and some of the countries that it split off into are vaguely on the side of the U.S. in some international affairs. So even though the other country with a lot of nuclear weapons, Russia, is still there with those nuclear weapons, they're not the focus of a buildup, or a focus of a retaliation in case we use nuclear weapons first. So you would think, with the demise of the Soviet Union, that the U.S. would have just decided that nuclear weapons were now useless, or almost useless. But, in fact, there are still many thousands left, and the reason is that most of those were not intended even originally to hit the Soviet Union, but to be deployed in the Third World in conventional conflicts, and that hasn't changed. What has changed in the policy is partly the public presentation and partly something substantive. In the presentation, the new Bush nuclear posture review actually goes ahead and says that the following countries are on our nuclear targeting list and that we will use nuclear weapons as an escalation step if a conventional war gets out of hand. And it just comes right up front and says that. That is not new, but what is new is the public presentation of it. It used to be that you had to dig very deep to find that that's what the nuclear policy was, and it wasn't just to defend ourselves against the Soviet first strike. So the possible use of nuclear weapons, first use of nuclear weapons in the Third World, was always there, but now it's an explicit public policy. So that's a difference in the in the coding of the policy, the way it's presented to the public. There is something substantive there, though, too, not just the shine on it. The U.S. used to be in favor of certain international arms control agreements, like the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, ABM Treaty, not because there were pacifists running things in Washington, but because these were areas that the U.S. did not see itself gaining a superiority. For example, Non-Proliferation Treaty, if we had a way of preventing small countries from getting nuclear weapons, have them sign that treaty, that would be great. Then the nuclear weapons would be confined to the party that already has them, or the parties. But nowadays, the U.S. government seems to be refuting the validity of any of those treaties, apparently operating on the theory that since the U.S. is so much more powerful now than any other country and doesn't have any real opposition, we don't need treaties. We can just do what we want. So that's also explicit now in the Nuclear Posture Review from March of 2002, that all of the above-mentioned treaties are not in the interest of the U.S. anymore.
Did you find that somewhat surprising, the minor amount of media attention to Bush's Nuclear Posture Review?
Well, one thing I found surprising is when there was media attention, it said that this idea of first use against third world countries was new. That's not true. In fact, large part of our book is showing that that's not true. So it wasn't new, and I found it surprising that the media often said it was new. But I guess the environment of the media since September 11th has been to pretty much tag along whatever the government is saying when they want us to frame our view of the world. They want us to think that the world is us good guys against the roving, more or less organized bands of terrorists. We are the law-abiding ones, and there are some rogue nations out there that protect terrorists, and that's the way the world is set up now. This view of things completely ignores the fact that the U.S. has been very aggressive and might call an imperialist in invading other countries and altering affairs for its own economic or political interests. If some other country was acting like Washington does, we would immediately identify it as imperialist. So that view of the U.S. government is basically innocent and passive and just being beset by hooligans around the world. That's something that the mainstream media has definitely picked up on. It's not a big departure from the way they've always handled U.S. foreign policy. U.S. foreign policy looks very different from the outside. When you look at the media, even from Western Europe, not to mention the media from the Third World, the U.S. is seen very differently. It's seen much more as an aggressive, abusive bully. From inside the U.S., we're sort of protected from that view. We're the good guys.
Do you think, based on the current public announcement of the Nuclear Posture Review, that we are more likely than ever to use nuclear weapons again?
You know, it's a little bit hard to predict such things because the rest of the world, including almost all of our allies except for Britain, are appalled by this now explicit policy. They weren't much in favor of it before, but now it's so bold and brash, and it's not just the threats against Iraq or our other favorite enemies that upset almost all the people around the world and almost all the governments too, but this stated nuclear policy is very upsetting. So it's not clear that even though the U.S. has the wherewithal to go it alone, that it actually will take the chance. So there is the possibility that international pressure will curb it. Also, of course, there's pressure from the American people. American people don't like the idea of starting wars against other countries. Even though the U.S. government has done that many times, that's not the way it was presented to the American people. It always was presented as the other guys were the bad guys and we were defending ourselves. Wasn't always the case, but American people are not, for the most part, bullies. So if there's opposition from the public, that could add to the opposition that's already present from the rest of the world and curb this bold, brash, and imperialist trend in Washington. But what's going to happen is a little hard to say. I would guess, and this is only a guess, that there is a split in Washington, because there's a lot of interests, economic interests, political, military interests, and interconnections around the world. The U.S. is very interested in making the world safe for investment by U.S.-based multinational corporations. If the U.S. government acts in a way that reneges on treaties and acts disrespectful to other governments and to the U.N., basically acts like it makes all the rules, this is very destabilizing, and it concerns many even powerful people in Washington that investments, influence around the world will be very disrupted. They don't like instability. So there are forces, even within the U.S. government, that I think are not in favor of this cowboy approach of George Bush and his crew. But how this all plays out is, you can't really predict too well, because in all these affairs, one thing leads to another, and sometimes the world gets into a situation where nobody wants to step back. So I wouldn't say that that just because there are some major financiers and bankers and multinationals that don't want to take a chance on starting nuclear wars in the third world, that it's not going to happen. It might, but I think there are a lot of forces arrayed against it.
All right. Well, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but give you a chance to share some last words or thoughts.
Well, there is one point about what to do. You know, if things look bad, then you could just try not to do anything or forget about it or hide. But there is quite a bit of evidence from the past that public opposition has helped curb the war plans of the folks in Washington. I'd just like to read one thing here from Nixon when he was trying to go ahead with these nuclear bombs in Vietnam. He said, he wrote this in his memoirs, "I had to decide what to do about the ultimatum. I knew, however, that after all the protests and the moratorium," that's that anti-war protest in October 15th, "American public opinion would be seriously divided by any military escalation of the war. On October 14th, I knew for sure that my ultimatum had failed. A quarter of a million people came to Washington for the October 15th moratorium." So even though government officials often act like public opinion doesn't matter, protests don't matter, organization of anti-war people doesn't matter, that's not true. They're not going to admit it, because to admit it would just encourage it. But it is true that there are many cases in the past where really insane war plans did not proceed because of public opposition. So I think people should keep that in mind, particularly in the next few months when we're worrying about Iraq and what might come of that, that public protest can make a difference.